Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. You know, I think when I look at being an entrepreneur, when people look back at what I've done and what I'm doing, I want people to see me as consistent, a gold glove, Hall of Famer kind of guy. So I figured I would bring someone in that's done a lot of that already. Before I introduce who that is today, today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult, and Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably, and has a platform to help you manage that team. Visit Fullscale.io to learn more. If you're not aware, that's my company, and we love talking to Startup Hustle listeners, so reach out. With me today, I got to say, I'm a little starstruck because I got one of my childhood and lifetime heroes on the show today, and that's Frank White. If you don't know who Frank White is, let me tell you, and this is going to take a second because the man has so many accolades. Played for the Kansas City Royals for 18 years, five-time Major League All-Star, was the first American League second baseman to win 8 gold gloves. That's a lot of gold gloves. 1980, voted the most valuable player of the American League Championship Series and led the Royals to their first World Series. Did it again in 1985. Nicknamed Smooth and Hoover. He's the guy, super consistent. Frank White, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Oh, Matt, thank you so much. I'm glad you reached out to me.
I'm really glad to have you on the show. And I got to say thank you for your continued commitment and representation of our hometown in Kansas City. I'd struggle to find many names and people that do a better job of that. Always was a big admirer of your work ethic and the consistency and stuff like that. So, you know, here we are with a ball player on an entrepreneur podcast. I think it's, even though I gave a list of all the stuff that you've done, I still like to ask everyone I talk to for a little bit of your own backstory in your words.
Well, in terms of entrepreneurship,
in terms of just everything, yeah.
Well, I mean, growing up here in Kansas City, I was we're talking a lot of years ago, and I was always one of those kids that always wanted money in my pocket. I'd always have a shovel on my shoulder when it snowed, a rake on my shoulder when the leaves fell, and a lawnmower in the summer. So I was always looking to make extra money, but didn't have any thoughts of that being entrepreneurship or putting together a lot more business or whatever that might be. But I know people that have, and they're very successful at it. And I know players that have started their own businesses, and so they are happy that they were happy doing that. And some of them are still happy doing it. And so my entrepreneurship now is just being able to do as many things in life that I never thought I could do, and just challenge myself at every level.
You know, we had another former Royal, Jeff Montgomery, on the show once and actually talked a lot about the entrepreneurship that athletes go through, because you're and well, you may have an agent or whatever, but coming up, like, you're your own product. You are your own startup. You know, what did that look like for you coming up to the major leagues, and what did you learn from that being your own business?
Well, we had I had a different start than most guys. You know, I wasn't a high draft choice. I wasn't even a draft choice at all. I mean, it was just me saying, when I was 19 years old, I've always been curious. I always never have been afraid to take a chance. And I decided when I was 19 years old that I was going to go down and try out for the Royals. And I asked my boss for a couple of days off, and I went down and tried out. And they were starting this experimental baseball school in Florida. So they selected me to go to this school. And then I realized, okay, I didn't have all the formal training that most kids have today. But I knew that I was a good athlete. I just didn't have all the fundamental stuff down to be able to do what I needed to do. But being in that school and working 6 days a week on fundamentals. And once I got the fundamentals down, then I'd say a good example is I was a month from turning 20 when I went into the academy. And this is after playing like 30 games in the summer. And I was in the big leagues in 73. So it happened that fast for me. And then once I got to the major leagues, then if you want to count this as being an entrepreneur, I said I was a shortstop. And I looked around and I saw the second baseman was older than the shortstop. And I said, well, it looks like he might be retiring a lot faster than the shortstop. So I said, I better learn how to play second base. So I went back to AAA, started playing second base. The next 3 years, I went to Venezuela in the winter 2 years and went to Puerto Rico 1 year. And then in 1977, when after 76 season, Cookie retired, then I was able to play second base on a daily basis. But from 73 to 76, we had no free agency. So we basically had to take whatever the owners wanted to give us. So we didn't really have any say over really what was going to happen to us until we went through a few strikes and got better benefits and got higher pay. And then when free agency started in 1977 and everybody in the open market came into play, then that's when you really saw how much value you had to your team as a player. And then you marketed that the rest of the way.
You look at so many people as entrepreneurs or startup founders are trying to develop a little street cred. You know, you talk about a lot of us are pretty young when we start our business, and you're swimming upstream against the experience you don't have. That I think that applies to your story. You talk about I think that it's probably fair to assume that like a number one draft pick is going to get maybe more opportunities or faster than an undrafted player. you know, did you have a chip on your shoulder? Did that motivate you? Did it make you want to wake up and prove everybody wrong? Or
I mean, I think that what I wanted was an opportunity. And I feel like if you get an opportunity and you're a good athlete and you put hard work with that opportunity, then good things happen. The only thing that a high draft choice would have over what I did was they would get more money when they signed, obviously. Where I signed, it was $50 a month. So they were probably getting back then a bonus maybe was like $30,000 a year. And so I had to work hard to get to where I wanted to go. And so you do have a chip on your shoulder. I mean, you wear it well, but you know that when it was time to practice, you had to practice. You know, when guys wanted to go out and hang out, I said, you guys hang out, I'm gonna work out first and I'll catch up with you. So I got real selfish about my workouts and I didn't want to miss anything. And so mainly you just say, hey, you know, we got all these guys who are trying to get to the major leagues and everybody's going to take a different path to get there. So you had to develop your path. And that started with getting the right roommate in the minor leagues and things like that. And just making sure that you don't get off track, and because you can get off track very easily.
What's an example of something in your practice routine that you, I find that people that are diligent about that kind of stuff, often their teammates and people around them kind of poke fun at them sometimes, that, you know, like you just hear the stories about the basketball player that shot 250 free throws and didn't leave until he made 30 in a row or so. I'd still be there shooting today. But was there something with your approach that everyone was like, wow, like he's that guy?
Well, to me, it was about your routine, your fundamentals. I would go out to a handball court and I would throw balls against the wall to work on my fielding technique. I would tie old when they had inner tubes. So you take a tractor inner tube, you cut it into lengths, and you put it on the end of a bat, and then you wrap it around a pole, and you just work on developing your forearms. Because we didn't have a weight program back in those days, so everything was done on your own. So I think the big main thing was just ground ball after ground ball after ground ball until you got that technique down. And when I got the second base job, my thing was I always wanted to be the best defensive second baseman play the game. That was my goal. And when I got a chance to play every day, my first year, I made 7 errors and won my first gold glove, and then I won 6 consecutive gold gloves from there and skipped a couple of years and then came back and won 2 more. So I just wanted to be the best. And I think that to be the best, you have to put yourself in a position to get there. And you want to be good, but you want people to like you for being good. So you have to be a little humble at the same time, and you got to give credit where credit's due. But the main thing is when you compete, you compete as hard as you can.
You mentioned finding the right roommates. I want to talk about that for a second because there's this really strong belief in the current world of self-improvement and achievement that the people that you're around, mainly the 5 people that you spend the most time around, you kind of end up being the average of what's in there. And, you know, with that, I personally take that seriously. I try to remove myself from people that are negative or people that just kind of, I don't know, there's some people that lead you down the wrong path. And I know that in pro sports, there's a lot of temptation and things that go on, you know, like what made you at, especially, it sounds like you did it at a pretty young age too. Like, I don't think most young 20s, anyone is like, you know what, let me find the most responsible or hardworking person to be a roommate with. But what made you want to do that? Or what did you learn from that?
Well, I was married at the time and had my first son. So even though we were separate, that gave me some balance. But I had a strong respect for my parents. And they basically, you just have to be humble. The same people you meet going up, you're going to meet those same people coming down. And really, I just wanted to say, just put myself in the best position to do what I need to do. And it all started with just making a commitment to yourself that you're going to be the best. When you are coming through the minor leagues, and if you're going to be an everyday player, then you don't want to room with a guy that doesn't play every day because that guy may not come in on time and that type of stuff. And the same way in the major leagues, you don't want to room with a guy who does, if you every day, you don't want to room with a guy that doesn't play every day. And so you always want to have that routine of going to bed at a certain time, getting up at a certain time, hearing the conversation that you hear, you want it to be a good conversation. So you room with guys that play every day, so the conversation is one way. So if you room with a guy that doesn't play every day and he's worrying about not playing and so forth and so on, so it keeps you in another mindset that you don't want to be in on a constant basis. At least I did.
So you mentioned, you know, the strong desire to want to be the best player you could be, and especially defensively. And you were a pretty good hitter too, man. Like the bat was working too. You see a lot of guys that win gold gloves that also hit 208. That wasn't you either. Now, when you're in this phase, like you mentioned winning a half a dozen gold gloves in a row?
I won 6 in a row, yes.
6 in a row. And then you didn't win a couple.
I think it was three years I didn't win.
So that happens a lot too. I mean, that's not an uncommon thing. And to be able to, so how did that affect your thought process? Because some people get defeated by that stuff. And some people, I know a lot of people too. I'm actually one of them. I'm not, okay, I'd love to win gold gloves and awards, but that's not really, I don't get up wanting to do that. I know that there's a legacy item to that, but like when you went through winning for a bunch in a row, and then, you know, I think it says something to come back and win them again. But well, did you have to make any changes? Like, how did that affect your thought process with that? How'd you get back into that gold glove phase of the game?
Well, I think the one thing that every year I tell myself, just be the best. I don't get into what if I don't win. Because I always feel like if people got to vote, then you might as well let them vote then see what happens. You don't want to set yourself up for a big letdown. So when I didn't get it, I just said, well, I had a good year. We move on to the next one. And then after 3 years, I came back and won two more. So it's just stand with it, stand confident in your abilities, and hopefully that other people will see it. Now, there was 1 year, I think 89, where I was about 38 years old, and I played 150 games and only made four errors. And they were four throwing errors, four different first basemen. So I went the whole year and never missed a ball, never missed a thrown ball, never missed a ground ball. And I thought that would be the year that I would get my ninth gold glove. And after only making four errors and after 150 games, and Harold Reynolds won the gold glove with 17 errors. So you just don't know when your coaches and managers are voting. So maybe they didn't believe what they were seeing at my age. So,
I think the thing I've learned with the gold glove in MLB is that it often has a lot of gold bat in it as well. I've always found that to be interesting because I couldn't tell you who won last year's gold glove at second base, but I've noticed that a lot of times that a really strong offensive year sometimes helps winning the gold glove.
It does help, but I think too, by today's standards, it's hard to get an error anymore. And I think if I played by the standards they're playing with today, it would have been a lot easier to play.
Meaning you think that they'd give you an error a lot faster then than they would now?
Oh, yeah. I think the accountability was a lot higher because you wanted to make plays for your pitcher. And I think today, if a ball's hit hard and a guy doesn't catch it, then it must be a base hit. You know, when I played, we just said, hey, if the ball's hit hard, that doesn't mean not supposed to get caught. So we had different standards. One thing I noticed is that if a guy holays a ball or if he doesn't get in front of a ball and the ball's hit hard, and it's a base hit. So you're always penalizing the pitcher at that point.
So 18 years of major league service is extremely long. That's a heck of a career. First off, people, like you said, most people just want to stay relevant, stay in the league. was there any point along the way where you thought about quitting or retiring?
No. I was always in good shape. I never had any serious injuries. In 18 years, I was only on the disabled list three times. I had two pulled muscles and a broken hand by being hit by a pitch. But I didn't have
that any. Might be the most phenomenal stat out of all of them, honestly. That's a lot of games, yeah.
So I never had a bad knees or bad ankles or bad shoulders or bad back, so even playing on turf. But I worked out year-round. I did tons of sit-ups, tons of push-ups. I mean, I just kept working all the time because playing on turf, your core has to be strong.
Yeah.
And so I stayed with that. And you get your 1 or 2 day things here, but for the most part, I was on the field. And I think I played 2,334 games.
The turf that you were playing on compared to what they call what turf is now are way different. You were playing on that green carpet that they have at the driving range. that was about what turf was back then.
That first year was horrible. They put a piece of padding down like you're laying carpet in your living room, and they had no drainage. So when it rained, somebody hit a ground ball through the infield. You had to chase it because it'd get waterlogged and wouldn't make it to the outfielder. And then they'd get these Zamboni machines to suck the water up.
Is that what they use then?
Yeah. But in the process, you were crushing the padding. And after a while, it just felt like you was playing on concrete. I mean, I had to take my spikes and get them ground up to the grinder and just get them as short as I could so my ankles wouldn't roll over. But the second turf they came out with, it was very good, and I really enjoyed playing on that.
That would have been what the early 80s at that point?
No, before that. So I'd say late 70s probably. But
there was 1 year George Brett. It was when he was playing first base. I remember he tore his ACL, and that was kind of a turf related thing. That might have been more in the late 80s.
We had turf my whole career. Yeah. So we never had grass while I was there, and we go to places like Minnesota. It was horrible. Seattle was horrible. Toronto was really, really bad. So a lot of people just didn't have the knack of doing it the right way. They run the seams the wrong way and things like that. So But that second one we got, they had underground draining, so we didn't have to worry about pooling water, things like that. So, I mean, I wouldn't have changed my career. I mean, I really loved playing on turf because it showed all the skills that you had, your quickness and things to arrange, things like that. So I really enjoyed playing on turf.
I got so in 2014, I went to all 89 home games for the kid, 81 regular, a bucket list item. I'll never do it again. But yeah, so I went to all 81 home games and then the playoff games. I felt like I injured myself just showing up and watching. I had like a whole new appreciation for the 162 game season. I was like, wow, because I don't think you ever get any time to heal when things go the wrong way. All right, so let's shift the topic for a second, because one of the things, you know, we talk about entrepreneurship and sports and collectibles and that has, oh my gosh, talk about the difference in things now and then. Was that ever a part of your, was that ever a part of your entrepreneurship as an athlete? Like, you know, you do appearances and autograph stuff. And I feel like that's like way different now than it would have been then. And by the way, I did find a Frank White autographed Royals ticket stub. I don't even know where it came from. I found it in a box a couple of weeks ago. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So we, this isn't the first time we've met.
Well, you know, we did that pretty much all the time. I mean, you have autograph sessions, you do personal appearances, you do speaking engagements, you do a little bit of everything. And that was part of, I guess your side hustle, I guess is an easy way to say it. But I mean, today it's more, it's more planned. There's more marketing involved today than it was when I played. And we just get an invitation here, an invitation there. It didn't pay very well.
The league didn't pay that well then either. No, so that's why, I mean, that's why I was asking, because for those of you listening, although he has passed, Frank and I share a family and known friend, Steve Boros, who is a major league player, coach and manager, and he was the Royals third base coach for quite a while, and I knew him, my mom and his wife were friends, but I remember I only met him a few times, but I remember him talking about he played for the Detroit Tigers a long time ago, and you mentioned being in the league after free agency. He certainly was not, and he used to work as a shoe salesman in the off season. And think about that now. Like, there's nobody that plays for the Kansas City Royals right now that is probably has a department store job, if any kind of job at all, in the off season. But the money was way different. So, like, how did that dynamic change for you over your career, or even compared to what it is now?
Well, my first 3 years were under the old reserve clause, so I played 3 years when there was no free agency. And in 1973, the average salary, the starting salary was $14,000 a year. That was minimum salary. And you get your standard 3%, 2% corporate raise, those type things. But in 1972, I was in AA. And at the end of the season, like you said, we had to work. We had to work from the end of the season to spring training. So I couldn't find a job for 6 months. So I went down to the Union Hall. They were building Kauffman Stadium at the time. And Mr. Kauffman's chauffeur picked me up and took me to the Union Hall. And I got a union card. So I worked as a union laborer from September of 72 to April of 73 when I went to spring training. And then in June 12th, I played my first game in the stadium. So I was the first guy to go from building the stadium to planning the stadium. And then my current job as a Jackson County executive, we own the stadiums. So it's sort of a weird deal.
Well, and now they're talking about building another one. Hopefully you don't have to go work on that one. I think call me, I'll go do that for you. That'd be the least that I can do. I asked ChatGPT to give me some info about major league salary history, just even over the last 20 years. Like, it, even in 2002, the minimum salary was $300,000.
Right. And then because of all the strikes we went to, all the walkouts. I mean, when I came in the game, you had to be in the league 20 years to even qualify for a pension. And so we got it down to 5 years and then finally got it down to one first day. And so that to me, I think the minimum salary now is what, $750 maybe?
It's 2020, it was 563, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. Yeah, it keeps going up. And yeah, that seems like such a big difference, you know.
That's a huge difference. It makes a big difference in how you get your life started. I mean, you can start by buying a house right away, where that didn't happen when we were coming up. So, and one thing too that people forget though is back in the 70s and most of the 80s, we were in the 50% tax bracket also.
Oh wow!
And so, a lot of the money got eaten up between agents and taxes. you had to really watch yourself. Pretty close.
Yeah, I want to here in a second. I want to talk a little bit more about how you kind of maintain the balance between work life and everything. Got to do some lifting here first, though, because remind everyone that finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult, especially when you go to fullscale.io, where you can build a software team quickly and affordably. Use the Fullscale platform to define your technical needs and then see what available developers, testers, and leaders are ready to join your team. Go to fullscale.io to learn more. I get in trouble if I don't do that.
So, I can see that.
Yeah. One of my favorite commentators for years too. So I think you get that. Now, one of the things that is really challenging about entrepreneurship and business ownership is that it rarely, if ever, falls into a 9-to-5 job. You know, like Murphy's Law says that the worst thing will happen at the worst possible time. And I can validate that Murphy has a strong influence on all entrepreneurs' lives, meaning like if something big is going to break, it does it on your first day of vacation or at 3 a.m. or something like that. And with that, a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with consistency and balance, similar to athletes, musicians, other people that are really passionate about what they're doing. We all oftentimes get obsessed with things too. And that causes a lot of turmoil. Now, in your particular case, you're talking about a lot of travel. You know, between spring training and 81 home games a year, you're gone a third of the time. Did you develop any I know we talked about roommates and some other stuff, but what were some of your tricks or what are your tips for balancing some of that and not having things fall apart around you?
Well, I think being married at the time really helped a lot because, you know, you had the family to consider that. That's enough in itself to keep you focused and keep you challenged. And I just wanted to be able to be the best player I could be. I mean, I think that you really just have to go fall back on your the principles that you were raised on. My mom always said that, you know, if you value your relationship with your parents and when you have to make a decision, always ask yourself, what would my parents think? And so you always have these balancing points that you go by. And then if nothing else, you pick the phone up and you call and I could talk to my mom and dad about anything. And they would give me pep talks. But the one thing that really helped me a lot and an awful lot, I've never been a guy that I wanted people to tell me what they thought I wanted to hear. I was a guy that said, tell me the truth and let me deal with it. And Hal McRae was my teammate. And Hal was the guy I trusted most. And I would go to Hal and I'd say, well, no matter what I ask you, I want you to tell me the truth. Don't try to sugarcoat it. Whatever it is, just let it go. And I really felt like that kept me balanced. I think that kept me from taking mediocrity and trying to turn it into something good. And I think it held me more accountable for being on the field, accountable to my teammates, accountable to the game. And I really felt like... that was the balance that I needed. It was just make sure and just getting up every day and knowing that somebody's expecting you to be at a certain place at a certain time doing a certain job. And I just focused on that.
I'm Hal McRae to a lot of entrepreneurs as well. And I've learned, you know, I tell you what, I've learned a couple things with it. Cause I say that I'm the guy that people call that. It's not uncommon for me to start a conversation. Hey, Matt, I'm calling cause I know you'll tell me what's up. You won't sugarcoat it and whatever, but I've also ruffled a lot of feathers with that. And so when people call me and ask me that, it's okay. First off, remember you asked. Second off, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. And I'm also not going to argue with you about whether or not I'm right or wrong. Because some people, like, they ask for the feedback, but they don't have that you tell them, and then they want to prove you wrong. They're like, oh, but you're wrong. I'm like, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but that's the way I'm seeing it. Now, whenever anybody that's like musicians and athletes stand on these stages that we all look at, and in this, man, I'll tell you what, I'm sure it's a lot different when you were playing, but I don't know how people do it now, because there's a million chat rooms, comment threads, like all this stuff. What is your advice or input or experience about dealing with other people's commentaries? Because I think in the history of commentary, there's always been haters.
Well, that's true. That is true. You know, when I played, once you set a standard of play, then people expect to see that standard of play on a year-in, year-out basis. Because people say, what was the most difficult thing about playing the game? Was it the 95-mile-an-hour fastballs? Was it the slider? Was it curveballs? No, it was maintaining that standard of play that people wanted to see on a nightly basis. To me, that was the most difficult. And I think that it wasn't hard because I was surrounded by good players. And we knew that we had a good team. We knew we had a chance to win when we went out there. All we had to do was do our job. And I was never concerned about the manager, who the manager was. I said, the only thing the manager can tell me in spring training is, I go in the office, and I'll say, okay, what do you expect this year? He'll say 140 games. I'll say, fine. And I'm out of the office. So I figured if a manager put me in a lineup, then whatever happens to me is my fault. Because I control what goes on at that point. So if you never get in the lineup, then you're going to complain a lot. So to me, it's about, I don't care who the manager was, as long as my name's in the lineup, and it was on me whether I was going to be in there the next day or not. So I just wanted to make sure that I just was focused on my accountability and being able to take good constructive criticism is something that's difficult for a lot of folks. And I think that if you're going to get better, then you have to be able to hear the bad, because we can always sugarcoat things and make you feel like you're better than you are. But if when you tell someone where they need their self-improvement or whatever it might be, or maybe go to a different business model or whatever it might be, this was not working, whatever, then they've got to be, first of all, in a position where whoever's giving them the information, they trust them. And if that's the case, then making that switch is not hard. But if you don't trust the person that's bringing the information, then you're going to go a different direction.
Yeah, the advice I give people a lot is listen for the echo. When it starts to sound like an echo, because you just hear the same stuff again and again and again and again, there's probably a lot of merit to what's going on.
That's true.
And I also give entrepreneurs specifically advice about, because they'll be like, hey, I'm getting a lot of buy-in on this. I mean, is it from your mom? Is it from your Uncle Steve? Is it like, you know, people that inherently aren't going to be like, yeah, your idea is terrible, like, don't do it. And, you know, like, who's it coming from? And I think that athletes getting, well, I know I've referenced musicians as well, because they feel the same way. They're either like really resistant to it, or they're like, or that's the most impactful stuff. Like a player telling another player something about their game is either fighting words, or they're like, or it hits home. It's like, wow, that's a peer. Did you find that? Like, you're very humble, and I believe that you could listen to it, but I know a lot of guys aren't.
Well, I think first of all, I think if somebody were to come up and just start banging on something that I know is not true, then I'd probably react a little differently.
Sure.
But the main thing is I asked for it. You know, I'd say, hey, this is what I want. But I only did it with one guy. I would never do it with two or three guys, just one guy that you trust. And that really helped me a lot. Because if you're going to get better, then you need to hear the things that you need to hear to get better. You're not going to get better if you keep doing the same old things and fail in the same old way. If someone has try this, try that, you practice it and it comes to you sometimes it don't. But you got to be able to hear it in order to be better. And I mean, I would go into a game in a 3-game series, 4-game series, whatever it might be, and I would go to the second baseman on the other team and I'd say, hey, look, I'm going to outplay you for 3 days. I'm going to outplay you for 4 days. Because I always challenged myself that way. And I was always a disciplined guy. I mean, I never got out of control. I mean, I played 18 years and never got kicked out of a ball game. And people say, well, why? You know, people would say, well, maybe you didn't care enough. Maybe you're not fiery enough. But no, it's knowing what you're there for. I'm there to play. And I would tell my manager, if I don't agree with something out there, I'm going to let you know. But if I don't see you coming, I'm going to walk away. Because it's your job to get kicked out, not mine. So my job is to play. And so when I had those guidelines for myself, then I stayed with it the whole time.
You were a manager for a while. Were you better at getting kicked out in that scenario?
Oh, I got kicked out of rookie ball. Yeah, managing. I tell you, most times you get kicked out, your players get you kicked out.
Yeah.
You're trying to support those guys. But the first time I got kicked out of a game as a rookie league manager, I had no clue what to do with myself. So I've never been here before. So I thought it was kind of funny in the end. But yeah, so at managing, you're always going to get kicked out of something for sure.
I'm glad you kept that standard of excellence on keel there. So some of the best advice I ever received was regarding like the ascent that we all have to whatever it is we're trying to achieve. Someone said to me that once, they said, Matt, what's easier, climbing the mountain by yourself or asking those on top to pull you up? And that was like one of those moments for me coming up. I was like, whoa, it was like in the Matrix. I spoke to the Oracle and I had this secret key. I tell people a lot of time after I heard that, I spent all my time looking up and yelling, can I get a hand? And I got to say, there have been amazing people that took an interest in me for reasons I couldn't explain. Some of it was maybe just because I asked or they saw something in me. Shout out a few of the guys or gals or whomever that pulled you up.
You know, your coaches always gotta come first. I mean, those are the guys that are gonna get behind you, and those are the guys that are gonna push you. And when you're minor leagues, they say, well, I had a AAA coach said you'd be a good shortstop in the major leagues, but you'd be a great second baseman in the major leagues. So things like that, and then you just keep working from that angle. But my biggest help came when I got to the major leagues. We had guys on our team that were veteran guys. They were under they weren't free agents. Under free agents, everything they got was going to be at the end of the year if we won any extra monies. So, but the advice I got when I first came up was Cookie Rojas told me, he said, "Well, when you learn when to do something and when not to do something, you're going to be fine." And I didn't have no clue what he was talking about when I started playing the game. Then I realized what he was talking about was your decision making. Once you learn how to make good decisions, then the game gets easier for you, and you learn how to win. John Mayberry, he said, "Hey, I don't care if it's sunshining, I don't care if it's raining, snowing, cold. I don't care if the ball hits a rock." He said, "If you don't make the play and the writers ask you what happened, say I messed it up," and that's all you can say. Don't try to alibi it. Just say, "I just messed it up." He said, because what you want to do is you want to make your mistakes and you want to admit your mistakes and then you want to get better from your mistakes. So these are the things that I learned from those guys. I mean, they didn't play in the gray area. They didn't say, well, what if this or what if that? They say, hey, this is a do or die game. Either you do the job or you don't. There's nothing in the middle. And then we move on to the next play. So the accountability was very high back in those days, and simply because we didn't have free agency and everybody was on 1-year contracts, and the big guys would say, your job is to set the table, my job is to drive them in. So you don't do your job, I can't do my job. So it wasn't like I go up there with a man on second base and I can't get him to third base for the big guy. It was like when I came to the dugout, nobody was patting you on the back and nobody was saying that's okay. They would say, what the hell are you doing? So because it was all about everybody's job. And that's what I think that's what helped me more, because I realized how important each player was to the team, because we all played a role and we had to be good at that role. And those guys, they kept you in line. They wanted to make sure that you knew that this wasn't a game where you don't get a bunt down, that you're going to come back to the dugout and they're going to pat you on the back and say, get them tomorrow, or they didn't play that way, you know. They want to know why you didn't get it done, and so the pressure was always on there for you to be the best you can be at that particular time.
I think one of the things I've learned the most about the team dynamic and the leadership dynamic is that key piece, you take responsibility. It's like you're using the term accountability, responsibility. The accountability is slightly different, but you know, if you mess it up, say you mess it up. I tell people that work for me, I've got 300 employees worldwide, and I'm saying, just own it, eat it, and get better from it. You know, because the thing is like, I guess I am the manager in that regard, and it's already passed. Like, we already blew the opportunity. You already made the error or struck out or something, and like a bunch of excuses for why. Sound like an excuse as to why you don't want to grow or get better from that. So, yeah. Once again, with me today, Kansas City Royals, Major League legend, Frank White, local celebrity here in Kansas City. Got to do my final heavy lifting here. I could talk with you all day about baseball. Today's episode's brought to us by Fullscale.io.
Alrighty.
Helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Sir, on the way out, like, what's the best advice you could just give anybody that wants to accomplish or achieve the improbable, like becoming a major league player?
I think first you have to identify what you want to do. Look for the opportunity to do it. And when that opportunity comes, give it your best shot. You know, we all want to get to the major leagues. We all take different paths to get there. But don't get hung up on what someone else got as a bonus or who's getting this opportunity. But you just have to wait for your opportunity. And when you get it, then you have to shine in that opportunity. Yep, it's up to you to change people's minds. It's like being a utility guy. And you get to play when a guy's out for 2 weeks with an injury. That's your job. Your job then at that point is to make the manager's job tough. Make it tough on him as to why he should put you back in the lineup. And you can do that a lot easier back in those days because of the one-year contracts and the low salaries. Today, it would be very difficult to do that. But you, at least you can play well enough to put doubt in coaches and managers' minds that maybe they should take another look at you somewhere else on the field and things like that.
Well, thanks again for joining me. Hopefully the listeners, they hear me talk. I make a lot of baseball references, knowing that people often don't know what the heck I'm talking about. So, you know, we could maybe revisit that at some point. Thanks again for joining me. Hopefully if you're listening, you learned that the playbook isn't different, folks. Like, I think the one thing I've learned is that success demands payment in advance. So start writing checks, because it's rare, if ever, that you're going to get to that place where you're winning gold gloves and World Series championships or whatever it is that you're chasing. You got to put in the work, and you got to stay consistent with it. I think that's what Frank White confirmed for us today. Thanks for joining me, Frank. I'll catch up with you. I'll find you on the base path somewhere. How about that?
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.